Working with nature is the question, or rather the topic that we ought to discuss today. And the student is firstly reminded of six questions that Maitreya asks, and the response to which comes in the very first chapter of Vishnu Purana. And the questions are as follows. How was the world created? How will it be at dissolution? Whence proceeded animate and inanimate things? Of what is the substance of the world? Into what has it been, and will it be again and again resolved? These are the six questions. Very interesting questions. If you come to think of it, look at the mind which is asking this question, which is probing into the very depth of reality, which wants to apprehend the soul of things and discern what is real. And look at the answer. I don't know who gives this answer. Probably Parashara gives this answer. Parashara gives this answer. How was the world created? By Vishnu. How will it be at dissolution? In Vishnu. Whence proceeded animate and inanimate things? From Vishnu. Of what is the substance of the world? Vishnu. Into what has it been, and will it be again and resolved, again and again resolved? Vishnu. He is therefore both the instrumental and the material cause of the universe. As Krishna says in the Gita, there is a supervising intelligence which makes things happen, which brings order to chaos, which reigns in the universe, and that is an impersonal, absolute intelligence itself. Right? And we have read in the Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali, a direct statement is made. Nature exists for the sake of soul's experience and emancipation. Bhoga apavarga. And if we go to the transcendentalist, the great writers like Emerson, he notices in his long essay, and the essay was so long that it almost became a book, right? He says, and I have noted these words from his essay, he says there is an endless circulation of divine charity which nourishes man. Preceding to this in the essay, if I remember right, he notices that everything in nature is circulatory. That is, what is put in one place is taken, gently extracted, and made to flow and circulate around the whole of the being, whole of the body, and in this case, the whole of the nature, such that in the process of circulation, there is nourishment, there is life, and especially he uses the word circulation of divine charity which nourishes man. Very intuitive writer, right? And if we relate this to what Krishna says in the Gita, when this circulation is happening, when there is this natural order in which there is reciprocity, when in which there is one party which gives to another, and in the very process of giving there is charity, there is love, there is nourishment, and the other party not merely receives it and holds it for himself or herself or itself, but there is something in this very process which it gives, which nourishes the first giver. So there is this beautiful circulation which is happening, and Krishna says that he who sinfully delighting in the gratification of his passions does not cause this wheel already set in motion to continue revolving, liveth in vain, O son of Prita. Right? So at the very outset, we are shown in ancient scriptures that the view of nature is one of reciprocity, nourishment, and mutual interdependence, as the Jain philosopher says, parasparo upagraho jivana. All beings subsist based on mutual dependence, interdependence, and nourishment. When this process of mutuality is broken, then to use the words of Shankara, sarva anartha karanam. It is the root cause of all the disasters, all the troubles, and all the miseries that man faces. On the other hand, when any person recognizes to whatever extent that he can, this reciprocity and affirms it through his own life, his own being, and living the life that aligns with this circulation of divine nourishment, he becomes a co-worker with nature. And to use the words of voice of the silence, nature then does not hold any secret from him. It opens wide before him all the portals, all the secrets, and whatever is deeply hidden in her bosom, she opens it and gives it to him and gives in plenty. Because man is not doing this, we see all the troubles that we are seeing in the world today. So this is the first set of questions that we saw, where Maitreya is asking about the macrocosmic reality. Where is the world? What is the substance of the world? Where did it come from? And so on. There is another Upanishad called Keno Upanishad, which begins also with questions, and which also goes to say how important is questioning, critique, understanding, and analyzing. Mimamsa, as they call it. The Keno Upanishad begins with a question which applies the same kind of investigative intellect to microcosm, to man. There the questioner has recognized, see, I have my body and the senses, that is real. So the body and the senses are working because of prana. The prana is working because of mind. So at all these three levels, there is something beyond, which is making these three work harmoniously. Who is that? Kena, by whom is all this happening? It says, the very first question, the disciple asked, by whose will directed does the mind proceed to its object? At whose command does the prana, the foremost, do its duty? At whose will do men utter speech? Who is the God that directs the eyes and the ears? So at all the three levels of reality, at the plane of the mind, the plane of the life principle, at the plane of the body and senses and organs, there's some directing intelligence. Who is that? One is at the macrocosmic level, another one is the microcosmic level. In both of these, as Marcus says, there is a reasoning intelligence called logos in Greek. And the logos in man is the same as the logos in the universe. Both the intelligences are one and the same. The purpose of the reason with capital R within me is the same as the reason which governs the macrocosm. This unity between macrocosm and microcosm is seen in various traditions. We will take for today's consideration what the Taoists say, Taoist philosophy, right? They recognize this idea of a Virata Purusha, as Vedantins call, where the universe is seen as the body of Virata Purusha, heavenly man, or Adam Kadmon, you may say. And they say that human being with his five organs are derived from five directions. And the same gods which preside in the various realms of the universe, and they recognize various realms, are residing in my various faculties. And there is this beautiful theme which comes in Taoist philosophy, where the disciple hears that he can find his teacher, his guru, in a certain palace at the feet of a certain mountain. And then he goes in search of the palace and in the mountain and traverses long distances to do this, undergoes various tests and trials. He reaches that mountain somewhere in China, tries to find the palace, and then recognizes that the instruction which was given to him was deeply symbolical. It was never literal in terms of Indians going to, for example, Himalaya and trying to find an ashram of the Guru. But he recognizes that the mountains and the palaces refer to places in one's own head. And it was there that he had to seek his Guru. Seek for thy Guru in the hall of wisdom, as the voice of the silence says. And then he comes back to his place and then begins his inward journey, symbolically taking all his scriptures and recognizing that his Guru is to be found within himself. Right? So this beautiful harmony between macrocosm and microcosm comes about very nicely in various systems. And if this universe is one single body, this nature with capital N, is one single being, not an aggregation, fortuitous collection of atoms as we study in Secret Doctrine. It's not randomly collected atoms coming together somehow with some mechanical laws working through them. But this is a single body with a single impulse running through it. Single impulse running through it. Right? And the visible world that we see, that we recognize through our speech, through our eyes, ears, touch, taste, and smell, these are but only the shadow of shadows of the real nature which is deeply hidden from our physical senses. Of course, man has those faculties in him, those senses in him, which allow him to directly perceive that reality. But man has not learned to use them. It has become dormant because his mind is deeply directed towards physical life as the only reality. If he only will redirect his mind to awakening of those faculties within him which corresponds to that reality, he will perceive truth, reality, as evidently as my hand can touch the book, my nose can smell the aroma around, or my eyes can see the objects around me. As evidently as that, he has those senses in him which he can use to perceive reality. Right? And this, there are many analogies, like the analogy of the allegory of the cave, very famous allegory in Plato's Republic, which comes. And we will take another allegory today, or rather a symbol, of the analogy of chariot, which comes in Secret Doctrine, right? Now, we are hearing the sound of the chariot moving somewhere. We are not seeing the chariot, we are only hearing the sound it produces. Like we are hearing the sound on the road now. But the sound is produced because there is a vehicle that is moving, right? The wheels of the vehicle are moving. The wheels of the vehicle are moving because there is an engine which is propelling it, or a horse which is drawing it. But the horse is drawing it because there is a driver, or an engine is moving because there is a driver of the car. And driver of the car is being directed by the owner of the car who sits in the seat behind. If we take this and apply it to nature, what we perceive through our physical senses and think it to be the sole reality is only the sound which we are hearing of the movement of the chariot. Behind the sound, there are the wheels, there is the chariot or the car and the engine and the driver and the mechanics which are working, mechanical systems which are working, an intelligent driver and a super intelligent owner of the car who is directing the drive. In this manner, the fire, air, water, earth, and ether that we recognize and perceive are but not even secondary, tertiary, or shadow of tertiary causes. When we speak of nature, when an ancient philosopher speaks of nature, he is referring to this point onwards, from the physical plane onwards, to that supreme intelligence itself. There is a science which encompasses the laws, L-A-W-S, of the entire nature. nature with N. And there the ancients recognize that there is a single impulse, it's a single body, it is all interconnected. There is no harm which can be done to one part of the human being in any part of the globe, which doesn't affect anybody else in any remote corner of the world or any other sentient being, because things are connected. You cannot think of anything which causes ill health to the intestine but causes good health to the heart, or causes ill health to the kidney and causes good health to the liver, because it's a single body, there's a single impulse, and health means welfare of whole. Right? In the same manner is a vision of nature that we get from the occult philosophy, where it is one being, one entity appearing as many. You cannot damage one thing and hope to benefit another. That comes out very clearly. And when man recognizes this and lives in harmony with beings around him, then the verse in the, where does it come? Book of Job, which says, "Thou shalt be in league with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the field shall be at peace with thee." This becomes a reality. Right? And now consider this question: what does this universe exist for? Right? And what is the purpose of all these beings, so many beings, variety of creatures? Only in the physical realm, only if you take one country, only if you take one portion, the Western Ghats of India, such a variety of flora and fauna and intelligence expressing itself through myriads of creatures. Right? What's the purpose of all this? We have to consider this quotation from Hegel, who is quoted in Secret Doctrine, to understand the one single impulse and purpose which runs through all beings, unites them all our lives of whatever being in this earth, elsewhere, is united in one common aim and purpose. That impulse, that purpose, that reason for existence, Hegel mentions it so well, and he says this: "The history of the world begins with its general aim, that is, the realization of idea of spirit only in an implicit form, that is, as nature." In other words, because the quotation is difficult to think about, I'm just trying to translate it. He's saying that the history of the world, that is, beginning of existence, manifestation, all this has one common aim, right? Realization of the idea of spirit. I capital, S capital, idea of spirit, right? And then he's saying further, a hidden, most profoundly hidden, unconscious instinct. And the whole process of history, that is, all the events of human life, racial evolution, appearance of species, disappearance of species, death, destruction, birth, rebirth, all these things, right? All these things is history. The whole process of history is directed to rendering this unconscious impulse into a conscious one. This vast congeries of volitions, interests, and activities, in other words, he's saying that we all have our passions, ambitions, desires, goals of life, and we strive and we have our priorities, we act. Each one is acting every day. The whole world is filled with beings who are actively participating in life, right? And he's referring to this and saying, this vast congeries of volitions, interests, and activities constitutes the instruments and means of the world spirit, capital world spirit, for attaining its object, bringing it to consciousness, and realizing it. And this aim is none other than finding itself. Finding itself. And coming to itself. Contemplating itself in concrete actuality. But that those manifestations of vitality on part of individuals and peoples in which they seek to satisfy their own purpose, like we are all doing. In our life, we are trying to satisfy our desires, our life goal, our purposes, right? He is referring to that and saying, in which they seek and satisfy their own purpose are at the same time the means and instruments of a higher power, of a higher and broader purpose of which they know nothing, which they realize unconsciously. Reason governs the world and has consequently governed its history. What a very insightful comment Hegel is making. He is basically telling that every individual's life, whatever purpose that he is trying to fulfill, in the course of that very fulfillment of purpose and his effort and struggle and life and smoke and fire of his life, there is an unconscious, unknown to him, a higher purpose working through all this. He may do good, he may do evil. Either ways, he becomes an instrument of some higher power. He can either choose actively to do good, he can choose actively to do evil. Either ways, he becomes an instrument of a higher power. Right? So personal life, though taken in itself, is almost meaningless. As the Persian writer says, what we are given is only a page from a large volume of book. And you find something scribbled on the page. It is a part of a great novel. You don't know the preface. You don't know the first chapter. You don't know the subsequent chapter. You don't know what is there in the subsequent pages and the eventual chapters and the conclusion. All you have is one page in the middle. And you are trying to make sense of the whole novel with that one page. Right? So that becomes the condition of man unless he knows somebody or he gets his hands on some body of knowledge which tells him what is there in the before and what is there later. Then the page that he has in his hand, which is his personal life, finds a correct, appropriate context in the universe. Otherwise, like a jigsaw puzzle, everything is jumbled up. You don't even know what is the picture that ought to have been the ideal which you have to make using the pieces of the puzzle. You are just given one piece of the puzzle and you are asked to not only imagine the whole structure, but to fill in all the blanks and make everything look all right, which is a difficult thing. And in this process of each one of us trying to know our own real selves, as Hegel says, the world spirit trying to know itself and becoming conscious through us, helping this process of each one knowing, each one understanding and knowing what we really are, is one way of helping nature, working with nature. For us to help others to go along this long, grand ride, grand journey, which in the scriptures is called human life as a pilgrimage. In order for us to help others to do that, we must first ourselves know what is the plan of the universe, why we are here, what is the purpose of this, all this, right? So we rely upon those beings who have gone ahead of us, who have seen the reality, who have glimpsed the whole puzzle, who have seen the whole book, and there find the context of our life, right? When we do this, when we obtain that knowledge, and when we help others obtain this light which guides them in their journey of life, we have done two tasks, two sacrifices, two yagnas, which are part of working with nature. These two yagnas are called Rishi Yagna, Nara Yagna. Sacrifice for humanity, not sacrifice of humanity for oneself. That's another path which comes later. You can choose that also. but sacrifice for humanity, oneself for humanity, and sacrifice yajna for the rishis, in the sense that the rishis, the great seers, the prophets of the whole world, not just of India, rishis of whole human race, and their philosophy, understanding their philosophy, aligning one's life in that light of reality, and helping other beings do that is Narayagna and Rishiyagna. Two ways of working with nature. And then further we see that you can either work with nature or work against nature. There is a universal impulse. There is a specific plan and a purpose and a design. But man has a choice. He can either work with nature or work against nature. Those are the only two paths. He cannot choose to be indifferent and non-choosing. Come to think of it. If man is buddhi and manas, the very nature of buddhi is the power to discern. The very nature of manas is power to choose. And if a man decides for himself that he will not discern, he will not choose, he ceases to become a man. He ceases to be of that stature which we call as human. Right? So discernment and choice is most necessary. And this is where nature opens two paths for all beings. You either work with me or you work against me. You can work against nature, because man is both macrocosm as well as microcosm. Man is not merely a copy of heavenly man. He is also a macrocosm, in the sense that he is a universe for all the beings which are there within him. He is composed of every single element which you can find in anywhere in the universe, in any of the realms, not only the physical. He is composed of, as the poem says very beautifully in Secret Doctrine, he is composed of this, a mixed nature. And the poet says, centered in our make such strange extremes, from different natures marvelously mixed. Man is that. Different natures, best of the animal substance, where do you find? In the kama of man, desire of man. Best of the intelligence, where do you find? Human manas. Best of the supreme intelligence, spirit, where do you find it? Its ability to express itself? In human kingdom, not in cows and dogs and animals and plants and minerals. In human kingdom, human state, that intelligence has the ability to shine forth, and man has the power to become a complete copy, working copy. We are all provisional copies in our current state. A sage is an actual working, dynamic, complete copy of the universe. We are all potential copies. Right? So man is both macrocosm and microcosm. How he is microcosm, we already see. All the aspects of his body, terrestrial body, has divine origin. Forget about his astral body, his pranic body, his mind principle, and spirit itself. He is spirit itself. So he is microcosm, true. But he is also macrocosm, because the five kingdoms of nature, fire, air, water, earth, ether, they all are composed of innumerable lives, L-I-V-E-S, lives, which make up his being. How do we understand this? Take, for example, stomach. It has its own peculiar intelligence. It has its function. And in the function, it is formed of tissues. The tissue of the stomach is not the same as the tissue of the kidney. It has its own intelligence. And in the tissue of the stomach, there are cells. The cells are composed of atomic beings, atomic substances. But the occult philosophy goes still deeper and says, atomic substances themselves are composed of innumerable lives. A cell, which is so tiny for us, appears like a universe for beings who are still tiny and which compose the cell itself. For those tiny entities, lives, the cell is like a universe. Just like this world is so vast for us, composed of so many rivers and mountains and intelligence working, a cell which is so tiny for us is, for smaller intelligences, like a world. And they all compose, intelligently work, follow the impulse of nature to provide an instrument for man. It is that which allows man to come in contact with nature, have experience, fulfill his grand purpose. And like in the beginning we saw, in every process of nature, anything that a being gives, he is compensated tenfold by something that he receives from other beings. Right? This is the process of nature. As the Tao Te Ching says, the way of the heaven and the way of man. The way of the heaven is to give, is to take from those who have more and give to those who have less. But the way of the man is to take from those who have more and less and add to his own superabundance. Right? So that's the way of man. But the way of nature is to compensate. So in this reciprocity between man and the lower kingdoms of nature, a harmonious design purpose is instilled in it, which is man obtains experience, and in the process of obtaining experience, he works and impels and propels the evolution of lower beings which composes his body and being. Right? So they give something to man, man gets something from them. This is paraspara upagraha jivana. But man can obstruct this process of evolution, just as we all know, especially in Bangalore traffic, it takes one idiotic person at the head of a traffic lane who doesn't drive properly in a single lane to cause a long traffic jam or a long, what will be, obstruction of traffic. There is no free flow of traffic. It takes only one fool to do that. In the evolutionary stream, a selfish man becomes that fool who obstructs the whole evolutionary flow. Left to nature itself, right, without man, all the other beings of nature follow their natural instinct. Instinct is unerring, and they follow the laws of nature. They are always true to their nature, dharma. But man is peculiar, like we saw, admixture of various kinds, and he has power of choice. He is the god for all the beings below him, and he can obstruct. How can he obstruct? By through selfishness. By not recognizing this reciprocity of life, not recognizing this mutuality of life, he becomes an obstruction to lower kingdoms of nature. And it is this obstruction and the reaction that comes from nature which causes lot of misery and suffering. Take the astral realm, right? Just like we have atmosphere which can be polluted through noxious gases from industries and other human activities, there is a mental, astral, psychic realm which can be equally vitiated, poisoned through our magnetism, through our psychic being, through our thinking and emotion. The person may not be polluting using, he may be cycling, he may not be polluting through generation of greenhouse gases, but he may be committing far greater crime against nature and obstructing the process through his very emotional, psychic and mental moral condition. right? How can he do that? Through selfishness. Because the separate self does not exist in reality. There is only interdependence and oneself. Interdependence of beings and oneself which shines through all, right? So, when man vitiates this, he becomes a destructive force, right? The various calamities that we see, what we call as natural calamities, we blame it on nature, force majeure, right? And calamities of nature, as if nature did it to us. The earthquakes and the tsunamis and the volcanoes and the climate change and various other things. They all have not merely physical causes, but man is the epicenter of disturbance in nature. Left to itself, nature is harmonious. It doesn't want to trouble any beings. It doesn't want to cause cataclysms and wipe out and cause pestilences and pandemics. It is man's moral nature which is reflected on the inner plane and causes such kind of disturbance there. And nature is a mere mirror. She reflects it back on the human kingdom and on the terrestrial nature and on the physical nature and causes cataclysmic, violent changes. So who caused misery to man? Man caused misery to himself and also to other beings. Right? And take our own senses, right? Look at, you know, when we use our eyes to see, use our ears to hear, it's not mere mechanical and biochemical processes that are happening to enable us to perceive the sound or see the sight. There are definite intelligences which work in our organs and senses to allow us to perceive life. They are called in Indian philosophy as Anga Devas. Anga is organs. Devas is intelligences which preside in those organs. And there is a subtile essence which run through these senses. And abuse of our senses is misuse of those powers. It seems the word Angiras, who is a sage, comes from this Anga Rasa, Angiras. There is an Angiras in us. Krishna speaks of it in the Gita. If we have time, we will go back to that. And how abuse of our senses is abuse of those devas or intelligences or so-called gods and elemental powers which are there in our senses. But the use of the senses and the body for the purpose for which nature gave it to us, afforded us this opportunity, will be again working with nature. The Deva Yajna. And being in harmony with the elemental kingdoms of nature, he performs Bhuta Yajna. So these are all the different sacrifices man has to perform in order to become a co-worker with nature. The other path, we will come to that, where he sacrifices humanity, elemental kingdom, devas, higher knowledge, and everything else for his own sake. It's a very, very difficult path, mind you. Don't think evil and becoming proactively, actively choosing the path of evil. It's not a small thing. It's not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing at all. It requires heroic effort and active assertion of selfishness and the courage to take such a kind of torment which our human imagination of an ordinary person is unable to even think of, because nature reacts upon anything which goes against its grand purpose. The whole force of nature is directed against that one small being. He has to have the courage to face that. Choose that path of evil. Then you become active co-worker with nature in its destructive path. It's not an easy thing. Those who have read Crime and Punishment of Dostoevsky. There, the protagonist there, Raskolnikov, what a character. He has worked out on wrong premises the puzzle of life, and he thinks to himself, the laws of morality, right and wrong, all these things doesn't apply to me. I am like the Nietzsche, his Übermensch, or the Superman, or the superhuman. I am that, and all these things don't apply to me. And he decides to commit a murder for moral purposes. And to his great surprise and horror, he finds that he is not the same person after committing the crime. Whatever intellectual justifications he comes up with for the crime that he committed, he is unable to bear the torment of his conscience. He becomes Raskolnikov before the murder and Raskolnikov after the murder are in two different universes. And Dostoevsky being Dostoevsky, with such great insight into the psychology of man, with great vibrancy and colors, shows the inner torment of a person who has committed a crime but not faced the punishment. Because conscience, physical pain is one thing, it's painful. More than that is emotional pain, right? Hand being cut off is probably less painful than losing a loved one. Emotional pain. But more than emotional pain is the pain of conscience and morality, which is unbearable. Unbearable. Why do you think many men and women plunge themselves into sense pleasures or plunge themselves into the social tumult or alcohol or any other substance abuse or addiction? Because it is unbearable. What our conscience speaks to us is unbearable. So we want to flush it out. And we engage in various things, hoping to, you know, silence that, which is impossible. So Raskolnikov, he tries to do that. It's impossible. Then he finally listens to the words of Sonia. Sonia means Sophia. Sophia means wisdom. I mean, allegorically, he listens to wisdom. And then he voluntarily goes and confesses his crime. Though the police had already apprehended somebody else as the criminal, he still goes and says, no, he is not the criminal. I am the criminal. Voluntary undergoes punishment for it, goes through the turmoil, purgatory, and purifies himself through the punishment, and then comes out of it spiritually wise. Beautiful novel. So this is being said to show that choosing the path of actively evil, assertion one's separateness and selfishness is not a small thing. We will read one portion from another character, Mephistopheles from Faust, the strange story of Dr. Faust by Christopher Marlowe. And there, the agent of devil, Mephistopheles, appears before Faust, because Dr. Faust has invoked the devil, because he is fed up of this life. He wants power and glory, and he actively wants to choose the path of evil. So he says, I will denounce the Trinity, abjure the Trinity, and then he invokes the devil, and the devil's right-hand person, Mephistopheles, arises. And then Faust says that, you know, this is what I want. I want power, glory, evil. I want to revel in evil. And look at what Mephistopheles says, right? So the context is Mephistopheles has come before Faust, and Faust is asking, who are you? He says, I am Mephistopheles, agent of devil. And what's your abode? Hell is my abode. And Faust asks, then why are you here on earth? Mephistopheles responds, why this is hell? Why this is hell, nor am I out of it? A very famous statement. Why this is hell, nor am I out of it? Right? Thinkest thou that I, who saw the face of God and tasted the eternal joys of heaven, am not tormented with 10,000 hells in being deprived of everlasting bliss? O Faustus, leave these frivolous demands. which strike a terror to my fainting soul. Mephistopheles is saying that, yeah, I am in hell is my abode. I am on earth because this is hell. And do you think I am not in hell because I am tormented? Why am I tormented? Because I have seen the face of God. I have tasted heavenly joy. And I am completely deprived of it now. I know the taste of heaven. And I am in 10,000 hell after having chosen evil, the path of devil. Right? I am in 10,000 hell. And therefore, first, all these demands that you have of power and glory and knowledge and ruling over men, leave these frivolous demands which strike a terror to my fainting soul. Right? So the path of evil is very difficult. It's not as we think. We are all like God says in the Bible, or whatever God says in the Bible, you are neither hot, you are neither cold, therefore I will spew you out of the mouth. You are lukewarm, you are meaningless to me. You either work with me or you work against me. There is no other path. Right? So choose to work with nature. It's a great, grand future awaits for man if he chooses to do that. Right? If he chooses to do that, he will have to be in harmony with beings below him. He will have to be in harmony with beings around him, that is, humans. He will have to be in harmony with intelligences beyond him. In all these three realms, he is in perfect harmony through working with nature. The impulse of nature is working towards unity, harmony, oneness, sacrifice, unselfishness. So choose that path is what we hear from the ancient teachers. So with that, we will stop here and